Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. This is a podcast about caves and cave exploration. If you're curious about caving, I would encourage you to get in touch with your local grotto. A grotto is a local chapter of the National Speleological Society, or NSS. There, you can learn what caving is all about. You'll meet new friends who can show you the ropes, so to speak. And you'll learn how to cave safely, which is the most important thing you can take with you. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. You don't just find a cave and go in. You get to know cavers. As you may have noticed, this month's episode is pretty long, so I'm going to do my best to keep this introduction short. Lou Bicking Award winner Dave Everton is my guest this month, and the Lou Bicking Award has been established to recognize a dedication to the thorough exploration and mapping of a cave or group of caves. That is verbatim what the NSS website says about the Lou Bicking Award, and I think it's pretty concise. We'll get to him in just a few minutes. First, I want to thank one of our sponsors, Organic Robot, on Etsy. Almost every grotto has t-shirts made for one reason or another, events, fundraising, etc. Most of them are pretty good, but they're also pretty specific. So if you want brilliantly designed shirts that just show off your caving hobby in general, or really almost any outdoor activity that cavers tend to also like, hiking, camping, climbing, you need to check out the Organic Robot store on Etsy. Charlie, the owner and designer, is a board member in my grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, and I personally own several of his shirts, and I always want more every time I visit the store. Many of his designs are available on moisture-wicking fabrics, so while I wouldn't recommend wearing them while caving, you could totally wear them while caving if you wanted. If you've got a caver or outdoor lover on your holiday list, get him something they won't find anywhere else. Original designs that proudly show off your caving or outdoor hobby. Just search Organic Robot and click the Etsy link. That's all one word, Organic Robot, click the Etsy link. Real quick, I actually managed to do some caving this past month. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that I'm a new dad. My son Finnegan arrived in May, so he's 6 months old now, and I am out of shape. I did a classic Indiana trip with my good friends Laura Demarest, who you heard on the October episode of the podcast, and Raymond Mal, who you heard on the Cave Capers episode. I was also delighted to meet Derek Bristol in from Colorado and a great group of cavers from West Virginia University led by Sean Hogman. As I said, it was a classic Indiana trip. We went to Wayne Cave, and this cave has a 1,200 foot crawlway, which, you know, wouldn't be so bad if I were in shape. And it wasn't that bad on the way in, but on the way out, it kicked my butt. We visited a popular formation area there called the RPI Passage, a name for the Rose Polytechnic Institute, now known as Rose Holman. A group of cavers back in the 50s discovered that passage, and then went to Camp 2. There are four camps in the cave. Camp 2 is, there's a big natural bridge there. And I had a Nalgene bottle full of leftover Halloween candy that kept me going, but I was pretty grumpy on the way out, being so out of shape. So poor Derek and Laura had to put up with my complaints in the crawlway on the way out. Thanks for that, guys. It was a little over 8 hours, so it was a pretty good little trip. I haven't been to that cave in over 5 years, though, so it was really great to be back. Thanks for the invite, Laura. And a reminder, you can also directly support the Caving Podcast on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/cavingpodcast. All proceeds donated to the podcast will go right back into the caving community in the form of donations to karst conservancies, grottos, etc. If everyone who listened to the podcast just gave $1 a month, that would be well over $1,000 a month going toward caving causes. Consider a monthly pledge or a one-time donation at patreon.com/cavingpodcast. And if you do, thank you. Okay, let's get to the interview. And stay tuned afterward to find out who my guest will be to kick off 2018 in January. It's a big one. Without further ado, this month's guest, Dave Everton, as you'll hear, is a pretty modest guy. He gives credit where credit is due. And according to him, that's almost never to himself, but he really does deserve a lot of the credit in doubling the length of Indiana's longest cave, Binkley, which is currently at over 44 miles. Back in the late 2000s, it was around 22 miles. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about him earning the Lou Bicking Award for leading that exploration effort. He also led a successful effort to clean up Indiana's infamous Buckner Cave. We discussed that. The guy's just done a lot. And we'll get to a part when we're talking about a certain crawlway in Binkley whose abbreviated name we mention, but we kind of blow past what it's short for, let's just say that it has to do with the male anatomy. You can figure it out from there. Just keep that in mind. I don't want to keep you in the dark. And as you'll soon hear, he clears up the legendary story Laura Demarest shared back in October about the cow, about how he hacked through a cow carcass that got washed into a cave and blocked the way. You'll hear his side of the story in just a few minutes. He's a longtime Bloomington, Indiana Grotto board member. Here is Dave Everton. All right. Dave Everton, welcome to the Caving Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. Privileged to be here.
I guess let's just get some quick background. I did a little background in the intro, but I guess how long have you been caving? What got you into it?
I started caving in probably late 1983 or early 1984, and I moved here from California. I was in the military, and the guy who I moved here to be with was from Bloomington, Indiana. He was in the military with me, and he took me into a cave.
Which cave?
Drum roll, please.
Okay.
Sullivan Cave.
Sullivan Cave. Yes. Oh, okay, that was my first cave.
Yeah, but, you know, this guy was a local, and he was, I love him, you know, but let's just say that he didn't know anything about caving. And it was flashlight, you know, bringing flashlights, and it's been a long time ago. I don't remember if I brought more than one flashlight, you know. Wouldn't surprise me if it was only, you know, grab a flashlight and go, and I didn't think anything of it at the time. We went to the mountain room, and we came back out of the cave. And
that was going to be my next question, was what was your route? Yeah, that was like my first trip.
Well, yeah, right. I think that's kind of a standard first trip for a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we went to the mountain room, and we came out of the cave, and then he took me to a cave called Reeves Cave, also in Monroe County.
Yeah.
We didn't go very very far, but I was hooked. Absolutely. That's all it took. I probably was hooked after the first trip, but basically when I saw all the formations and the first, there's a room in Reeves Cave called Ben's Room, a few hundred feet in, that's just heavily decorated, where there's Sullivan's not.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, that was it. That's all it took. Hooked.
That was it. Besides Binkley, which we'll get to later, what have been among your proudest caving accomplishments from, say, the early days before you started going into Binkley? Or were you pretty much just recreationally caving before you took on the Binkley project?
I actually did a lot of recreational caving when I first got started, and did a lot of caving in 1984, and kind of got that out of my system, if you will, I guess.
Yeah. Time to get serious.
Well, it's not necessarily that. For some reason, I was attracted fairly early on to project caving. There's a caver who got out of caving, who I haven't talked to or seen in years. His name is Tom Nugent, and I worked with Tom. Tom worked for a surveyor in Bloomington, and I, for a short while, worked as a part-time, you know, with that outfit. And Tom liked to survey caves, and he liked to draw cave maps, and that really fascinated me. And so around 1986 or so, I started doing that with him, started learning how to survey, started learning how to draw cave maps. And from then on, I've been primarily a project caver.
So, but you've been known to kind of do some crazy things to push. Laura talked about the dead cow incident. So I want you to clear that up.
Crazy is in the eye of the beholder, okay?
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
So that is like way blown out of, that story, I don't know what's told.
Well, clear it up for me.
I will.
She said that you chopped your way through a dead cow to continue a survey.
Did you ask her if she was there?
No, well, I assume
ding, 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 ding,
ding, ding, ding. You gotta clear that up.
I will. Okay, so a little background, and I had to look this up because I don't keep this stuff off the top of my head. But when I heard her mention that, it's like, okay, all right. So my first visit to the American Bottoms Cave.
Okay, this was in American Bottoms.
This all right. American Bottoms Cave in Greene County was in November after Thanksgiving 2007. And a friend of mine, who I did some stuff with at the time, named Roger Daniel, his cousin owned a cave in Greene County. And so Roger went out to this cave on his own with his son one time, I think, and then came back and told me, hey, there's a fair amount of cave at this cave, you know, and you might want to come check this out with me. So we went out there with him. Will Ott was there. And American Bottom's main entrance is a surface stream that goes into the ground. So it's a big swallow hole, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of a walk-in entrance, but it's essentially a sinking stream. So I noticed on this very first visit that there was a cow, a dead cow, in the stream outside of the cave.
Outside
of the cave, okay? Yes. Key phrase.
Not in the
cave. Okay. At this time.
I pictured you hacking away with a
machete. Well, we're not there yet.
Okay.
So we started working in this cave, and me being the project caver kind of person that I am, I started investigating what information had been recorded and documented about this cave. I don't like reinventing the wheel. So I want to know, find out what people at least have published or done or know about. And I determined that it was American Bottom's cave. Okay. At the time when I went out there, I didn't know that. Determined that, started working out there, and the cave can flood.
Yeah.
Okay. The water that flows into the cave entrance there, there's a bottleneck in there, or more than one, and once it starts backing up, it can back up considerably, including cover the cave entrance, which is big. So if there's stuff on the outside, guess what's going to happen to it?
It goes in.
And guess what happened to the cow? Right?
Yeah.
So the cow ends up in the cave, right? So after a particular flood, and there, it just so happened too, Matt, that there was more than one way around there. It's kind of the first few hundred feet are kind of mazy. So that the cave is kind of unique in that the roof of the cave, a lot of it is in sandstone. And in fact, the first part of the cave, you're completely in sandstone. And the limestone isn't seen until you get a little further into the cave and deeper. The contact, they call it, between the limestone and sandstone is further in the cave. And there was another route. So the first time we discovered that the way that we wanted to go was blocked by sticks, you know, debris, and all sorts of things, including a cow, we were able to go around.
Okay.
But going around was a little bit of an inconvenience, and it was kind of a pain compared to going the route that the cow chose to, you know.
Right.
So after a few times of going around, and some time went by, I decided to try to see if I could get through. And it just so happened that I was by myself, and there's no witnesses to this immediate part. But some other people were in the cave doing something, and I decided to go see if I could get through in the area that the cow had plugged.
And by this point, what state was the cow in?
That's a good question, Matt. The cow, I think the insides were kind of largely, like, decomposed. Not there anymore. Yeah, I believe so. Because I was kicking on pushing, they call it donkey kick, you know, you kind of brace yourself and then push with your legs.
Yeah.
And the cow would not move forward, you know, it was still intact enough, the ribs and stuff, but I don't think that there was a lot really left inside the cow by that point.
So was the smell then still terrible?
Oh, no.
So it wasn't?
No, not by then.
Okay.
So enough time had gone by again. Actually, what happened was that Will Ott had set up this little mini website for trip reports and various things that we used to write, and I used to have that on a particular server, and I didn't look at home. It's at home on my computer, I'm sure, all those files, but I couldn't look up the specific trip reports or whatever, but I'm just generalizing here. So, specifics are that I was tired of going around the cow, and I wanted it to be gone.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to move it. And at one point, I've got one of the legs, and I'm, like, bending it up and, you know, trying to get this thing pushed through. And that day, there were some other people further in the cave, and I worked to the side of the cow. Not through the middle of the cow, but to the side of the cow. And I cleared away enough debris that you could crawl beside the cow to get through.
Okay.
And I think there was a group in there, and they were able to actually come out that way because they were at a point where they could have maybe gone either way, and I had it cleared out enough by that time that they could come out. So I think this is where the story started. Right?
Yeah.
These people that came by the cow changed one little word, the word by, to the word through, that they crawled through the cow. So that was the birth of that story, and whatever it's turned into to various people, I'm sure there's...
It's still extraordinary, though, because I don't know if I could run across a carcass as big as a cow in a cave and be like, you know, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to go past this thing.
It's just a cow carcass, you know? I mean,
I guess if it were at the point where you say it was, where it wasn't smelling bad, it wasn't in the middle of decomposing, it had pretty much all gone. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you want to call that a crazy thing, go ahead and call it a crazy thing. It saves a few minutes, time and effort and various things like that. You know, to me, it was no big deal. You know, I have to say, you know, I was hoping for something medium rare, you know. It wasn't quite so tasty.
No.
And later on, it's interesting because you see what could be called nature in action. You know, later on, the cow continued to
decompose, disintegrate,
and parts of it got washed. And you know, after a while, you wouldn't even have known.
Yeah, unless you found something significant.
But I'm sure the traces of that cow, you know, were left here and there. And I've always said you never know really what's in a cave when you go through one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's good evidence right there. There was a piece of a cow scattered all over the place, you know.
So then, so there's the cow story.
Okay, there it is.
There's beginning
there
and end.
There's my version, and I'm sticking to it.
So what, besides Binkley, have been some of your biggest caving accomplishments? Like, what worked you up to the big Binkley project?
When I started doing the project caving, like I told you, it involved surveying, and for me, it involved making a map, drawing the map, plotting the survey data, drawing a map. And I also like to write, so it involved writing about the cave, what we saw. I learned how to take pictures in caves, or at least take one so that it just didn't look black. And so I liked the whole package of documenting a cave. So I got involved with the Indiana Cave Survey, and early on, kind of an early version of that is Blends. Because Blends maintained some information out there. It was a very much a hot spot. People were caving. They were coming and talking to him, tell him, hey, there's a cave here. He kept some notes, a lot of notes, actually. And he also kept the National Cave Files. I don't remember if you guys talked about that.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, but he wants the NSS to come pick him up.
Right. So Blends and others were collecting information, and Blends had a lot of information. And then that information was turned eventually into an electronic data set, early database stuff. And then I came in around a time that after it had been converted, Randy Jackson, who's a longtime, you know, BIG caver and Indiana caver, and he was the one who had put it on a mainframe, put in an electronic format. And then after time went by, it was decided to move that from that environment to create like a private environment. So I got involved in the early incarnation of the Indiana Cave Survey. I wasn't a founding member. I liked small projects. I favored caves that could be mapped in part of a day, a day. And you could go out and do it, collect all the information I needed to document that cave, do a write-up if necessary, if it needed mapped, map it, and move on to the next project.
Yeah.
That was for years what I really liked, kind of kept my interest, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't visit the same cave very often. And if it was, it was for other reasons.
Yeah.
But
I'm starting to see a lot of irony that you then picked up the Binkley project later.
There's lots. And we're leading up to that,
too. Yeah. We'll get to there.
The American Bottoms project was actually probably at the time the biggest project that I'd been involved with, of the cave being larger.
Yeah.
and getting more people involved. And I actually did make a note here. We took 24 trips, and there was 43 different surveyors involved, a lot of them just one time. And we stopped at 2.87 miles and left a lot undone.
Yeah.
And that was the biggest cave project that I'd ever taken on as a survey project, you know, up to that time. And that was in 2007, 2008. And before then, just a little bit before then, I got involved in helping survey a cave in Kentucky called Webster Cave.
Mm.
And it's near the town of Webster. And the guys that were doing this, and that, unfortunately, that cave had been surveyed more than once. And they were doing, they were trained by Pat Cambyses, you know.
Oh, yeah.
To do the very, very detailed A++++ kind of survey work and maps and
sure.
all that. And they had already done a bunch by the time I got involved. And I was just a helper with that. I just went on some trips, and it kind of gave me insight, I guess, and access to a large cave. As Webster, I think, is close to 10 miles mapped, and it's a river cave. There's a lot of water in there. I love water. I don't know if you kind of got heard that yet or not. But
well, I mean, kind of known. Yeah, with heading the Binkley project, you kind of have to like water a little bit.
So the Webster got me interested in
bigger,
larger
caves.
Projects or bigger yeah. caves. And that was all kind of primed then when I was introduced to Binkley Cave in 2008. Gary Robertson asked me to take some photos. He'd been told by Dave Black or somebody maybe that I might be willing to take photos and for the book that he was writing, 50 Years Under the Sinkhole Plain.
Yeah.
And I like taking pictures. And so I went with Gary and some other cavers on a trip, took a bunch of pictures for his book. And we took actually a total of three photo trips, I would call them, for the sake of taking photos for the book, involving different people in different parts of the cave. And me being the project caver person, the mapping, surveying sort of person that I am, I was really intrigued as I took these trips to learn how much was undone, how much had not been done in
yeah.
this cave.
Well, and a lot of that was just because it was Gary, and they didn't have quite the technology that we've got now.
That might be part of it. I think it's a little bit more than that. But I know Gary was on your show, you know, and you talked with him in detail. So I'm not here to represent Gary.
No, of course not.
But and actually Terry Creighton, and I'm not sure if you know who Terry is.
The dog.
Yes, Terry yeah. the dog. He was the one of the masterminds of the project. He was the map data guy, and he kind of coordinated the survey, essentially.
Mm.
I got the impression they just weren't quite as open back then either. Understandably, you know,
yeah.
different groups throughout history have had their own caving projects, and they become theirs, and they take ownership of them, and you know, they're open to varying degrees. I can't speak to all that, but I saw how much there was to do.
Right.
And here's a guy who had always wanted to do small projects that you can finish up and move on to the next project. Somehow I was swept up with this cave.
Well, that's great.
I never, ever envisioned being drawn and fascinated to take on a project that basically will never end.
Yeah. Well, we're getting a little close to Binkley. I want to hit Binkley toward the end.
Okay.
So let's back up. You're a big cave photographer. You've got a good eye for it. I guess when did you start seriously doing cave photography? Almost anyone who's ever been in a cave more than once has taken a few pictures, but you've really done a lot.
I've never called myself a cave photographer, Matt. I've actually always
you wouldn't call yourself that, but
no, I always say I'm a caver who likes to take photos.
Okay. All right.
You know, that's never been my focus to be the cave photographer and to take the prize winning shots and submit them. You know, I'm not knocking that. I'm just describing that's not me. My photography has always been to support my documentation. So
strictly utilitarian, that kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, here's a cave. What's the expression? A picture says 1,000 words or whatever.
Sure.
You know, get some pictures along with whatever else you're doing that can actually show the cave. I like doing cave photography. I enjoy it. I put some effort into it, but I've never considered myself a cave photographer, but that's nice of you to say. So I like to take pictures.
Do you then have any cave photos that you're particularly proud of? Like maybe one that you blew up poster size and hung in your house?
Or? I don't have any poster size ones, but yeah, there's definitely some ones that, you know what, it's a lot of it, to my opinion, is luck.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
yeah.
For me. Now, not saying somebody who's skilled relies on luck, but I've been told since then that even photographers who go out and shoot for magazines, a lot of times will take many, many, many pictures, photos, yeah, for the one that they're really thrilled with or that ends up in a magazine.
Well, I'm sure the same translates to what you've done.
But yeah, there's I've had a few shots that I am pleased with and proud of the way they came out.
You've taken some gorgeous pictures in Wayne Cave. I've seen that album before. I'm sure, I mean, you know, this is just what I've seen. I'm sure there's countless others.
I actually made a few notes on that because, again, I don't keep this stuff off the top of my head, Matt. I just do what I do.
Yeah.
And I may document, but as far as keeping it and remembering it, I don't. But, you know Bob Armstrong?
Yeah.
I vividly remember Bob did stereo photography.
No kidding.
He did. Slides. Okay. No surprise, really. Bob was I don't even know the extent of how incredible that guy was. I just know him a little bit. But I remember coming up to a CIG meeting, and he gave us all 3D glasses. And watching a 3D slide presentation on Wayne Cave.
Oh, my word.
It was amazing.
I would love to have seen that.
And I felt Wayne like cave. I was there in a cave.
And yeah, and Bob was one of the earlier explorers.
He was. And it like blew me away. Now I never tried that. It required special equipment and stuff. And
I can't imagine hauling all that through the crawlway and taking all those pictures and, you know, having the wherewithal to get all that done.
It's just part of what people who love caving will do to do what they want to do.
And he was certainly one who would do just about anything.
I've lugged stuff and I've had other people help lug stuff.
Yeah.
It's funny because the various cases that I've used, I have an old Army ammunition case, the green.
Yeah.
Kind of a pain in the butt, especially for crawling.
It's heavy.
Well.
It's kind of heavy.
And it's clunky.
And clunky, yeah.
Yeah.
Noisy.
It's got sharp corners. Then I've used a Pelican box, Pelican 1400 case. And I'm known for those who have been with me for the sound of the case dragging along. Whatever noises it might make in particular areas. Not that I drag it all the time. You know, I take care of my stuff.
Yeah.
But there's times when dragging is the best way to transport.
Yeah. Okay. So that leads me to another thing, because it's so easy to just let your stuff get beaten up because it's just more convenient to just let it get, you know, let it go to hell. I don't know. Is there anything that you do to make sure that your stuff isn't completely wrecked after a few years?
You know what? I think everybody's different on this. Like, for example, I've been in a habit of washing my cave clothes after every trip.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of guys who just, you know, maybe set them out, air them out. You know, they dry with the mud on them or whatever. They show up to the next cave trip and they're putting on these clothes that oftentimes creates a big cloud of dust like pig pen on the, and I just go, you know, and get away. But I don't care. I mean, it doesn't matter to me how anybody else treats their gear. And I'm not saying I'm an angel. It's not about that. It's about that there are certain things that should be taken more care of than others.
Well, especially if it's expensive, like and photo gear.
Photo gear. I've unfortunately been careless. For example, one time I'm wearing American Bottoms, and the Pelican case that I've used, you know, has an O-ring seal on it, and I would take the seal out and clean it. Of course, clean the case, clean all the grooves where the seal fits inside, because if you pull the seal out, there's still a bunch of dirt in the groove. That's probably not going to do a good job.
Yeah.
Anyway, this was a different kind of carelessness, because I get in the cave, I open the case, and it's full of water.
Oh.
What I had done, I believe, was I used like small towels, and I put all the equipment in there, and I had the case foam lined and stuff with a hard foam, and put towels on top, like for an extra cushioning or for wiping your hands or whatever. And I was careless, and the when I closed the lid, the towel was sticking out, thereby creating a gap, allowing water in. Yes. So
I wouldn't know that. I don't know that I would call that careless so much as unlucky.
Well, you know, I could have been more careful when I closed the lid.
Sure.
This is something that when you're doing this stuff, you have to be careful with the stuff in the cave. First of all, you want it to work.
Yeah.
So I would like to think that I have taken some precautions to be careful, but things happen. Can I turn the tables here and say something while we're talking about that?
Sure.
When I first heard the podcast, I knew of it had for a while. I figured I didn't have time to listen to your podcast or anybody's podcast.
There's a lot of them out there,
but I heard the Dick Blends one, and I was just stunned. It was like, I know Dick. You know, and I was like, it was like I was in the room with Dick Blends.
Were you at all surprised, though, that he was able to talk that much?
No. No, Dick, this is an amazing thing. I don't know how the guy lives by himself, and he's such a social person.
Yeah.
I'm fine with being by myself, too, Matt. I mean, I really do get that.
Yeah.
I'm a social person as well. But here's Dick, who's a great... an amazing, interesting person who's done like gobs of stuff in his life. And when you talk with him, he's just easy to talk to. And he tells great stories and stuff. And it was like, this podcast was like, I was sitting right there in the room listening to Dick. And so I thought, I've got to listen to all these. And I realized that I could do it at work, which really helped. But you do an amazing job, Matt. I had to ask you, do you edit these things? Because I couldn't tell.
That's the biggest compliment I could receive.
And it wasn't like I was listening and saying, oh, gee, what's he doing here? I thought, is he hitting the pause button? You know, is he editing? These things are so seamless. They just flow in such a way. It's perfect. It's like flawless. And I was like, how is he pulling us off? You know?
Well, I want to make sure that they're good. You know, I mean, there's not a caving podcast out there. And I wanted to make sure if I was going to do the first one, it might as well be decent. Well, and I got a background in all this audio stuff and recording and microphones and things like that. So I figured, you know, why not translate that? Why not take that to caving? You're known for your photos. I want to be known for this.
Well, I tell you what, you have me impressed, and you're easy to talk to. You are very pleasant on air. You just, you know, your personality is just perfect for doing this. And you're actually doing something that in different formats that I've considered trying to do in the past. Not this, not how you're doing it. But there's just a wealth of information that's out there, especially with some of these old-time cavers.
Oh, I know.
That's going to die with them.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it hasn't been published. And this is just such an interesting format. It's so much more personal to hear a conversation than it is to pick up something and read it. Reading is great.
Yeah.
But there's something about in-person, human-to-human communication like this. That's just so cool. And your excitement, your enthusiasm for doing this comes through marvelously. It really does. You know, and that makes all the difference.
I appreciate that, Dave.
So I had to stick that in there. For you readers out there, or listeners, not readers, listeners, you may not appreciate what Matt puts into this, but he does an awesome job. Am I Mr. Radio qualified to say so? No. But I am a musician, Matt, so I'm used to listening to sound.
Yeah.
And listening to how things sound.
Yeah.
And you do a great job.
Well, you said you're a musician, and you've kind of started focusing on that more so than caving lately.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Actually, you more or less just came from a gig. It's Sunday morning.
Earlier this morning.
It's Sunday morning when we're recording this, but you had a gig last night. And so you play around, and you're in a band called Soul Stricken.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys play what? Classic rock?
Classic rock.
Yeah. And you've played some Cave Capers Saturday nights.
Right.
And really rocked out.
Friday night.
And Friday night too, yeah.
Yeah, the open jam. Ron Adams open jam.
Yeah. Next time we do a Cave Capers, which, by the way, we've got the location and
already
we've got it already booked. Because,
wow!
Well, because I took over as chairman this year and really really procrastinated on a lot of stuff, and it just really stressed me out. So I'm like, let's get next year booked right now, and then before next year, I want to get 2019 booked so that we can put it in the guidebook. Say, hey, we'll see you at this place in 2019. We'll see if it happens. But
you know what, Matt? I think one of the really cool things I love about Capers is that they change location. Now, I know that it's a lot of work, and I can't imagine to the extent of which, because I've never been a CIG involvement, except just helping a little bit, right?
you've given some excellent presentations at meetings.
But I love the fact that they have it at different venues and different locations. I don't go to Capers for caving.
You go for the social aspect.
I do. It's an opportunity for me to see people that I don't see on a regular basis, and I really like that. So I appreciate the fact of what you're doing, you know, to help in that way, because it must be kind of thankless, you know, to do it year. Maybe you haven't been involved, but year after year, some of the people that are doing this have done it for a long time, you know. And if you had a venue that you know everything about it and go back to year after year, then it takes a lot of that work out of it.
Oh, yeah.
But the fact that you choose new venues or different venues, I realize, makes it a lot more work. And I truly appreciate that. Capers, I just think you guys, CIG has done an awesome job in the years that I've attended, and I thank you for your support and participation in that.
Well, it's my pleasure. And you said it was thankless. I don't know. I didn't necessarily see that this year. Last year was so sparsely attended, and this year was so well attended, and everyone said that everything went well. So, I mean, I don't know. The board, not just me, got some nice compliments on how it all came together. And we really appreciate that. And I appreciate what you were saying
now. That's good. You know, you can please some of the people some of the time, but you can't please all the people all the time.
You got to know
that.
Who those people are going to be.
Well, you got to know that going in.
Some people who just complain about everything.
Well, I know that, and I those aren't the people that I want to hang around, quite frankly. So
you had talked about the social aspect, and we were talking about Dick Blend, so I'm kind of circling way back, and you had said, I don't know how he could live by himself all those years. I mean, obviously he didn't. He invited all those people all those years to come to Buckner Cave, and he had, you know, hundreds of people a weekend if it was nice summer weather. You kind of give us some background on Buckner, because you kind of spearheaded the cleanup project to a degree, right?
To a degree.
So
I tell you that, I want to tell you that I used to hate Buckner Cave.
All right. Let's go there.
It was about 1984, my first exposure to Buckner.
Early days of your caving.
Yes, early days of my caving, and I did not like it.
Well, by that point, it was in bad shape. I mean, well, 84, that was kind of height of party caving days.
I don't think it was the height yet.
No?
No, unfortunately. But I don't know what
that... It was bad in the 70s, though,
right? I don't know. Yeah. Don Paquette's got pictures taken in the 70s of the signature room, or you know, late 60s, early 70s, and it was already, you could just tell.
Yeah.
You know. But some of the reasons I hated it were, I care about how people cave, you know, and how people treat the cave. And if they're unprepared and all that, you could go in there at any time, and you don't know how many groups you're going to run across, most of which are unprepared, shouldn't even be there.
Well, you know, used to be.
Now, it used to be. That's what I'm saying. In 84, when I started going, or where I went, this is what I saw, trash, anything goes, you know, kind of stuff in there, and I just did not like that. So I had no desire to spend time in Buckner Cave. Fast forward years later, what you may or may not know, the success of Buckner Cave now, in my opinion, is solely hinges on one guy, and his name is Art Gayheimer.
Yeah, because he moved in 2001,
Art, I don't remember the years, and I don't know the years, but Art moved on to the property in his camper, his truck / camper, at Dick's agreement.
Okay.
Because they were friends.
Yeah.
And Dick allowed Art to be the property manager, if you will. And Art ran off everybody. I don't mean everybody down to the every person, but pretty much everybody. And Art was a very unique individual. He was one of these guys that didn't care what you thought. In fact, if you were belligerent with him, he'd bring it on. He'd just put it into a whole nother mode. If you were kind to him, then he knew how to be kind. Gruff still, but kind.
Yeah.
But if you were belligerent, if you acted like you had the right to be there, you were messing with a guy who, I don't know, I'm not suggesting that he would take violence into his hands, but I wouldn't push it.
Yeah.
But Art did Buckner Cave the biggest good that anybody could do. He ran off the partiers. He lived up there and made it his mission to run people off.
Yeah.
And, the best thing that could have happened to that cave and property of anything, because it was a free-for-all. Everybody knew that they could go there anytime they wanted to and do whatever they wanted at that property and in the cave. Mm-hmm. And Art put a kibosh to that.
And Dick was just, what do you think it was? Dick was just too nice to run people off? He didn't want to be that guy?
You know what? So you'd have to ask him. You'd have to ask him.
Yeah.
You know, I do understand that early on, it was a calculated decision that they were going to try to make Buckner Cave what they called a sacrificial cave.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he talked about that with you. I don't remember necessarily hearing that on the recording, but they thought, okay, if all the vandals will come here, let's let them come here and destroy this cave so maybe they won't go anywhere else. And I don't fault that. I can't fault that. It's an idea that as things are going and you just try something, and they tried something, and it turned into what it did. It wasn't good for the cave. It wasn't good for the property, but they tried it, and that's what they did.
And it turns out that it was an okay cave for that to be the case, because it's not a flutter. It's not a particularly dangerous cave. It's just one of those caves where you could just really let anybody in. If they don't know what they're doing, they could run out of light and, you know, have to have a rescue or anything. But you're not talking about anything other than a few incidents, maybe a handful over the years where there was a really serious problem that arise from all this unfettered access.
I'm amazed. You know, I will parallel it to the fact that there were things out there that happened that I don't know about, and I'm not trying to be the expert, because I'm not, but I just know from being around some of the people who had to deal with this stuff that they were constantly going out there looking for overdue cavers and finding them in the cave and all sorts of stuff like that, you know. But it is amazing, really, that worse things didn't happen, or maybe we don't know, you know, always about stuff that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But Art did that. I credit Art Gayheimer almost solely for doing that. And had he not done that, the cave would not have the success that it's had as you know, like being able to clean it. They used to clean it all the time.
Yeah.
Haul trash out of there, you know, and then, you know, time goes by and it goes right back to being as bad as it was.
Ugh.
You know, and I've got pictures of, I think, Willie Hunt. It's a Willie Hunt picture that I have, or a couple pictures. I call it the Wall of Shame, otherwise known as the signature room.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so incredibly terrible. It's unspeakable. So the project that we undertook would not have been even undertaken had not the cave already changed from being an uncontrolled
free-for-all
to some managed access where we thought the changes would actually stick.
And that started with Art and being there.
In my opinion, that started with Art. It started with Dick allowing him.
Sure.
And then it started with Art, because Art, he lived for it for the 4 years or whatever he lived up there and did that. He lived for that. And that's what nothing else would have worked, I don't think. Dick couldn't have done it, even if he was working. Art lived. I don't know. You know, I don't know him so well that I know how much he came and went. He didn't hold a day job, so.
So then you took on the cleaning project, what, around 2005?
I think so, and I didn't look any of that up, you know, before we met. Dick used to go to the NSS conventions every year.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the conventions he went to, he saw a demonstration of some equipment that some Arizona cavers had set up to sandblast paint.
Yeah.
Off cave walls.
Yeah.
So he sees this demonstration, and this group had put together all this equipment. It's called a Pepper Sauce Cave Conservation Project.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick came back and told some of us, about this equipment. Not only about the equipment, but the fact that this group was actually welcoming other groups to borrow it. They'd used it for what they wanted to use it for, and they were loaning it out.
Mm-hmm.
So we pursued that and found out that we could use it. And it was down in Tennessee at the time we were given permission to use it, and they had used it some. I don't know what all they did with it, but they were done using it, and we got permission to use it. So a few of us went down there and got the equipment, brought it back, and started a project to clean or try to, I call it put a Band-Aid. It's like putting a Band-Aid on cancer.
Yeah.
You're really not restoring anything.
Yeah, but you're taking the worst parts, the signature room, now called the LV Cushing room, because you don't want to encourage anyone to go in there and paint it up again. You're taking that room, you're sandblasting the what, quarter inch almost of paint off of that wall?
We started in the entrance room, did some stuff in there, ignored a lot of the crawlway,
yeah,
just picked a point and said, okay, let's start here. So we started working toward the T, and we had crews working more in one place. There was enough equipment to have three different crews working in three different locations. So to say that the wall of shame in the signature room was one of the highest priorities would be correct. Because, you know, it was just horrific.
Yeah.
So, we did that for a while with their equipment.
You had scaffolding in there. You were sandblasting. How long did it take to just clean up that wall?
Matt, I don't have that off the top of my head. I, you know, months.
Yeah, I mean, it months. Took several trips.
We didn't, first of all, we didn't do it every weekend. You know, we weren't working in there every weekend or anything like that.
Who just would want to?
Once a month, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, I kept all that information. It's just not close to my head right now, but I think average of once a month. Yeah, it took a while. What an accomplishment.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people to help. If you don't mind, I'd like to just stick this in there too, Matt, because it's one of the things that I wanted to mention. One thing that I've noticed about caving, and really about life in general, is that any of us are only successful because of what others have done before us. Any of us.
Of course.
You know, and we have access to what other people did, and we have access to people in the current now, in the now. And it's cavers have continued to build on the success of others before them or the present, you know. So it's like anything that I've been had opportunity to be involved in, I can only give credit to those who were before me or who have been my mentors or whoever else, you know, because it's just such a building block, you know. So these cavers will build, and the next group will come along and they'll build on top of that. And then it just continues to grow like that. So the sandblasting effort was a lot of people that helped. You know, mm-hmm. I called myself the coordinator for a while, and then Bill Bouse took over. He has continued to work in there for years, mm-hmm. you know, and he's worked in the Volcano Passage the last few years and finally wrapped it up and did as much as he's going to do in that area of the cave. But then since then, he continues to go in there and take trips to remove more graffiti.
Yeah. Every time you go through the cave, you'll find a little spot where they've got some wire brushes and stuff set up to where they can clean up more graffiti. So he's really, he's still working it.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And for him, there's no schedule. It's like when I was coordinating it, I scheduled days and I tried to get volunteers there and that kind of stuff. And he has more flexibility in his schedule. He likes to lead youth groups. So he kind of exchanges going through the cave for doing some restoration and that sort of thing, where he'll just take it as it comes kind of thing.
Well, you'd said, you know, you're only as good as the people who came before you. And I think that kind of humility is what made you such a good leader for the Binkley project, which I guess we can kind of move into, because everyone who came and helped got credit for what you were able to accomplish in there. And you're always quick to, you know, give credit where credit's due. And you just got an awful lot done in Binkley, which ended up earning you the Lou Bicking Award, right?
Yes. That, you know,
I can tell you're uncomfortable to talk about it.
In my opinion, no, it's not uncomfortable, Matt. It's more like put in the correct context. I feel like the Lou Bicking Award is a team award.
Yeah, of course.
There's no way that any one person or two people can go out and survey a cave. If they do, it's going to be really slow and it's going to be really inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
The Bicking Award is only representative, and I don't mean to diss the people who give the award. That's not what this is about. But there's only one way to get that, and it's through the team.
Yeah,
it's through the people that are going out and doing this on a weekly basis or whatever it may be. And the award happened to come to me as a person, but as far as I'm concerned, it was a team award.
But you were the one, but like you said, coordinator. You were the one coordinating all that.
You know, somebody's got to do it or try to do it.
Sure.
And I never call myself a good leader. I was a coordinator, and I did my best, and it was an awesome thing. But it really did. It's the team. It's the people who do the work.
Let's talk about Binkley. Let's go back to your very first trip in Binkley. Do you remember when that was, or was
June 2008? I don't remember the exact date.
That was your very first trip in Binkley.
Well, 2008. Let me back up. I had taken one trip during a hog fest.
Okay, yeah.
Which was an event that the Harrison Crawford Grotto, when it was in existence, used to put on every year. I think it was always the first weekend of May or something. And Aaron Atz, who was a longtime Indiana caver, was fascinated with Binkley Cave, and he took trips in there and stuff at different times. And Aaron told us how to get to a particular location called Helictite Utopia.
Ah, yes. Yes.
So he gave us explanation, and some of us that were attending this hog fest decided to go down there. You know, we got permission from the owner to go. We decided to go to try to find this location in the cave. We actually did. We went to Helictite Utopia. Interestingly enough, I had taken my camera back in there with some photo gear, and there's a location nearby there called the North Formation Y. And I took some pictures there, and I left the camera there because it was getting on in the day, and I knew we were expecting some crawling and stuff, and just didn't take it back all the way. But Ty Spadam had his camera, and he took some pictures. And so we got some pictures back there, and I took a few pictures in other areas. But that was my first trip in Binkley Cave. We were in there, you know, for a long time, but I think we missed by the time they had food at the end, you know, we come back and there's none left.
Oh, man.
You know, which has happened to me more than once because I've been busy caving and not as picky about getting back for the banquet, as they call it. But, yeah, that was my first trip in there.
Did you start working it shortly thereafter?
No, it wasn't until a few years later that Gary contacted me and asked me about taking the pictures.
Okay, yeah. And so then that happened, and what, you had known that there was probably a lot more to this cave. There was a theoretical connection between Blowing Hole and Binkley, and you wanted to work that. And
I didn't know about that stuff until I started hanging around with Gary, you know. When I took three photo trips, and Gary went on two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And from hanging around him and talking, you know, and hearing about the cave, you know, everything started coming together for my interest in it.
So then I guess the first move you made to really start extending the length of Binkley then would be what? When did you start thinking, okay, I could take this on as a project, or to just kind of fade into existence?
Well, you know, it just kind of came into existence, and like I said, I got fascinated with it. And I've always been, like I said, leaning towards surveying. Surveying has always been what I think is an important part of a cave's exploration, is surveying, mapping. Sure. Mapping what's been found, documenting. So the first kind of project that I took on was, Gary took me to an entrance called a Bales entrance, you know, for in the process of writing the book. Because the ISS opened up this entrance to Binkley Cave, and it had been since closed, you know, Rockfall. And I asked him, I said, okay, what's accessible from this entrance? You know, is there things that were remaining undone? You know, what's the potential of working from this entrance to continue to map the cave? And he said, well, the strike section, of the cave, that entrance was reasonably close to the strike section, and that there was a lot more probably that could be, you know, benefited from and found through that part of the cave, through the strike section. So I said, well, what do you think, you know, is a possibility of us, you know, reopening it? And he knew the owner and got permission, and we reopened the entrance. So that was the first big, I did that with the idea that, based on what he said about potential, you know, I had to think about what is the best chance of success, or what advantage do we have to do this? And that's why, because he felt like that was a part of the cave that could benefit a lot more from further work.
And so then what was the first big, I guess, breakthrough?
The first big breakthrough was really exciting, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
It's really exciting. It Gary called it Book Avenue. So basically, there was a room in the cave that they'd known about. The old ISS members had known that this was a good lead. And Gary actually created a list for us.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He created a list of spots that he felt like were good spots.
Check here. Yes. Check here.
Uh-huh. And good dig potential, good air.
Yeah.
Air is essential. And hitting the air at the right time of year. So these guys, you know, he created the list for us based on his many years of involvement. And so a group of us went to the living room with the intention of pushing it. And we brought some crowbars and, you know, maybe hammer and those kind of hand tools.
Yeah.
In case they were needed. But it was known as a low cobble crawl past the living room. And nobody, to our knowledge, nobody had pushed it. So it just
is that
happened.
What became known as the D&B crawl?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you going to ask me what?
No, D&B? No. I already know.
Oh, you already know. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, but anyway, the D&B crawl. This was fun because a longtime Binkley caver, Pete Cresselius, who's a doctor, who mammoth Roppel cave fame guy.
Yeah.
Okay. He quit Binkley caving to go cave in Roppel, and he came back on a visit and went with us on this trip. So one of the reasons we chose this location, because he was a hardcore Binkley caver, this guy.
Yeah.
Okay. And we chose this location, and we actually broke through. You know, we got past the cobble crawl, and it started to open up. We did have to do some moving rocks aside. It was nothing major. It was only, you know, cobbles and stuff. You just move them aside and, you know, continue on through the crawl. And it opened up. And it opened up big because we eventually walked into this three-way junction, you know, it was a junction of three different passages. We're like awestruck, you know.
Yeah.
So much to do here. It was so cool that he was present on that trip, because he was one, he spent a lot of his time and effort for a certain period of years, you know, exploring and surveying in Binkley Cave.
And here comes his big...
I think that particular discovery was bigger than what he'd have been involved with in the cave.
Wow.
Up to that time.
All right. And so you found that room with him on the trip, and how cool.
It was way cool. You know, and here's a guy who I'd read about some of the stuff that he did through Gary's book, and that was my first time of meeting him. And then I had also read one of the books on Mammoth Cave, which includes stuff that he was involved with Roppel. And it's like meeting a legend, you know?
Yeah.
And for him, knowing the kind of trips that they went on and some of the stuff that they discovered as a result, this just kind of was a different type of discovery.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
we discovered this big borehole passage that we just stopped. We just stopped surveying and looked. We didn't go scoop or anything, as also Laura introduced you to the term next trip investment, which is definitely calculated and stuff. But anyway, Gary, I think, named that section Book Avenue.
Okay.
Because the discovery was kind of, it was the book that he wrote that led to the discovery of this part of the cave by us starting to work the cave, and by going there to that area. He called it Book Avenue.
Okay.
So I was telling about names earlier, you know, and how I'm the name Nazi. It's not always easy. I try to find a name that might fit the passage.
Yeah.
Either by physical characteristics or something that somebody could say, oh, I can see why they named this.
Yeah.
And that's timeless. Whereas a person's name isn't quite the same.
Yeah. Well, it's always nice when an area can name itself.
Well, and it does take some effort, I think. But there's a cave called Miller Cave, and longtime caver Norm Pace, he had, as a teenager, surveyed Miller Cave. So the only map that we have was one that he and some friends of his made, okay? And it was long suspected that Miller Cave was tied into the Binkley Cave system. And when we were working in Blowing Hole part of the cave, we were kind of looking, you know, you go survey, you come out, you plot the data, and you look at where the relationship to the surface is. So Blowing Hole's generally kind of heading for Miller Cave. And of course, Gary, he just, Miller Cave, you know, he had in his mind that we got, you know, let's tie into Miller Cave. Isn't known to move a lot of air.
Yeah.
So at a point where we finally started getting close to Miller Cave and we found a really nice section of passage, I called it the Miller High Life. You know, a kind of a dual meaning here on the beer.
We do. All right, let's set it up for everybody listening. We just took a break, and I was showing Dave my our beer bottle cap collection, and pointed out the Miller High Life, and so that's why I laughed so hard at that. Anyway,
and we were talking about some commercials and stuff, but see, and here's the thing. Here's the twist on it. Okay. Miller Cave was not known to be this nice, wonderful, beautiful piece of cave, you know?
Yeah.
It was a lot of crawling. And so I envisioned this is getting us close to Miller Cave, and this would be like a highlight of Miller Cave if it connects. So let's call it the Miller High Life, you know, in anticipation of it connecting. So, and it actually did.
It is.
Later. So,
oh, that's great.
You know, that's the kind of odd twist sometimes that I will work with on names. And you know, in this case, we didn't make a connection, but it was getting close. And I thought this would be probably the nicest part of Miller Cave if it was, you know, connected. So the High Life.
You knew you were close.
Yeah.
Yeah, at that point.
And I've also got, this is great, Miller Cave, a lot of trash washed in, went way back in the cave. In fact, there's an automobile's tire in a section of passage leading up to what I call the High Life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the Blowing Hole side, there's an automobile tire sitting in the middle of the passageway. This is not a small tire. And we're like, if an automobile tire washed in, there had to have been an opening that humans could have fit through. We couldn't find anything obvious from the Blowing Hole side, so it's kind of a mystery.
Yeah.
But other stuff got washed in there, and including beer cans. Guess what kind of beer can got washed in there?
Miller High Life.
Yeah. Ding, 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 ding.
Old style cans, like, you know, old.
Yeah, older, you know, cans.
Yeah.
So I've got a picture of Jesse Hauser. Okay. And I took a picture of him coming out from underneath a crawlway, making it look like he, you know, had a Miller beer can in his hand in the Miller, you know, on the way to the Miller. Well, it was actually a Miller Cave.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You well, know, what's more appropriate than, you know, drinking Miller beer in Miller Cave?
That's marvelous.
Yeah. So,
all right. So then let's talk about what you accomplished as the coordinator of the project, I guess, as you could say.
I and an army. The well, army, yeah,
you,
with me.
You and the army. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
But you can speak for the army.
We accomplished quite a bit. You know, and it's interesting, Matt. There's many interesting aspects to me that go into this. The cave has to be cooperative.
Yeah, of course.
So without that,
where are you going to go?
Where are you going to go? Right. So first of all, the system accommodated our work. You know, it gave up. And sometimes it was with a lot of persistence. We didn't just make big discoveries every week. It wasn't like we were waltzing through.
You had to be patient with it.
We had to keep attacking it. And the nice thing is there was so much to pick from that we could kind of pick and choose what we wanted to work on. And we kind of let those people who were the most active participants in the project kind of help us with that and guide us. And people had different areas of interest and stuff. And like I said, we started out with a list that Gary made. We've never got all the way through that list necessarily. It's been a while since I've looked. I used to go back and update. You know, if we added to the list, I had that on the website, and I would post some updates as what we did and different things, you know, with those leads and refer to trip reports that we... Big on documentation. But the cave accommodated our efforts.
Mm-hmm.
So generally I tell people that Binkley Cave was mapped at about 22 miles at the time we started working there, or at the time of my involvement with mapping. Nearby blowing hole had been mapped almost to 2 miles. But essentially, during the time, like you said, that I was involved, you know, heavily as in coordinating, we added almost 20 miles to the cave system.
You doubled, essentially doubled the length.
Just about.
I mean, you connected blowing hole?
Yes.
Did you connect Miller, or was that later?
No, we connected Miller.
You connected Miller?
It was on Tim Pride's birthday. So it was a series of, and this is another thing. Had we had to do it all through one entrance, it never would have happened.
Never would have happened.
So the having multiple things to work on gave us, you know, opportunities to expand the system and continue to expand it. You know, we would, like when we connected blowing hole in, actually we mapped 7 miles proper. We mapped 5 miles adding on to the nearly two. And at the time we connected blowing hole to Binkley, we had mapped about 7 miles in blowing hole. Okay, total, including the old ISS.
Sure.
And so the next thing was to focus on, hey, trips are getting long and there's like low airspace bathtubs to go through, the safety factor and when you choose to go. You had to be picky about that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, consider the impacts of flooding and various things and just the human physical limitations. I always say I like my own bed to sleep in, and Binkley and Blowing Hole are not friendly caves to camp, and nor do I ever want to.
Yeah.
You know, that's not me. Some people like to camp in caves. I'm not one of them. I don't even sleep very good camping out, say, for capers or something like that. The idea of camping in a cave, especially Binkley, was never appealing to me.
Yeah.
But so these were all day trips, and so you had to look at the limits of our ability to go during a certain time period, and I lived an hour and a half away travel, and some of the guys lived further than that. So, you know, you had to account for all that, and, you know, we had some pretty late nights, let's just say.
But what were some of the longest trips that you took?
I didn't take as long as trips as, like, Joe Kinder and some of those guys who went back, like, you know, forever. It's funny because I was on the trip that Laura described and Joe described of discovering what we later decided to call McLean Mountain Room.
Yeah.
And I get entrance fever.
All
after
right.
we're done working, you know, after we're done.
You just want to get the hell out.
Yeah. Pretty much.
I can relate.
So on that trip, I was actually, and I'm not suggesting, I'm not a super caver. I don't go at these rates of speed. You know, Brad Barkham, that guy, he's like the Energizer Bunny times four or whatever. He conditions himself, he exercises, he does all that stuff. He has amazing, you know, speed. I'm not like that. I take my time, just get there, pace myself and that kind of things. But even on the trip out that day, we left, some of us, Joe, Laura, it was Joe, Kinder, Laura, and I, at least, we decided, okay, we've gone far enough. We stopped surveying. We started heading out before anybody else did. And so the rest of the people that were in there on that trip went on to find another big room. So I haven't actually been back to that part, and I probably never will, but I've seen Joe's pictures, amazing pictures. So they were going slower than what I normally would have chosen to do. But when you're doing something like that, you don't want to, you know, we're 7 hours travel one way from the entrance.
Yeah.
So you kind of want to stay together.
Yeah.
And so we did. We stayed together, and I've also never been one to really eat a lot in caves. You know, even on a long trip, I'll bring a few candy bars and a bottle, but that's about it. I don't eat a lot, and others do, and everybody has a different style. But so we were going out of the cave. And then I think at one point I decided, hey, you guys are okay on your own. You know, I'm heading out. So I continued heading out, and I made it out. It wasn't even 18 hours total trip for me that day. But then I just hung out on the surface, and waited quite a while for the others to come out.
Yeah.
I'm not one to like to lollygag. There's times when you're just tired, and there's one particular trip, a different trip that Pete Gracilius came on to the Book Avenue. And we had a guy get sick on the way out, and that seemed like excruciatingly slow. But you got to deal with it.
Yeah, of course.
And that was an 18-hour trip. That was actually the longest trip in Binkley that I can remember doing.
Wow.
That was one of the Book Avenue trips.
That's a good long trip.
So even the McLean River trip, for me, wasn't an 18-hour trip.
So you were leading the charge when you found the section that eventually became Indiana Caverns, Indiana's newest show cave, which Gary Roberson is part owner of, and wrote a book about opening up that part of the cave as a part of, or developing it as a show cave. So what made you tell Gary that, hey, you know, I know you've thought about developing Binkley into a show cave. I think I found a part that we could use for that.
That wasn't actually me. And Gary didn't correct you either, man. I'm not, I just want, he pronounced his name Roberson for whatever it's worth.
Okay.
Anyway, it wasn't me. It was Rand Hazlett. But I did know of Gary's intentions of finding a section of Binkley Cave that he could commercialize.
Okay.
But it was Rand, actually, who talked about that with him. This is one cool thing I want to segue here, because Gary went on some cool trips with us.
Yeah.
You know, here's a guy who turned me on to Binkley Cave, who is responsible for me getting this in my life, right? And his enthusiasm for Binkley Cave is just amazing. You know,
well, it's been a lifelong pursuit since the 60s.
Right. And just to see and be around him with that enthusiasm is just infectious, you know? And here's a guy who thought that he was kind of done, right? And he ended up going on some trips with us to see some things that he didn't ever think that he would see. For example, there's an area called Grand Dome. Grand Falls, that's what it was called, Grand Falls. So we found a shortcut to this location in the cave that they'd only dreamed of being able to go back to, right, that they'd been to years ago. And it was a big trip, long trip for them back then.
Yeah.
And we found a shortcut to get there. So he was able to go with us on a survey trip to Grand Falls and beyond. And it was like, and I can't take credit for it, but at the same time, it's just so rewarding to see this guy who loves the cave get to do some
and
things.
And who is of a certain age.
Yes, he is.
You know.
He's in his 60s.
Yeah.
And so it was just, it was like, we were always encouraged and encouraged him to participate and say, Gary, you can do this, you know, let's do this, you know, and he got to visit Miller High Life, you know, that was one of the trips that he got to do. And, this was bad, Matt. It could have been avoided, but the Bales entrance, one day we decided we were going to do a through trip. We were going to go to a certain part of the cave. Gary and I split off from the others and did some stuff, and we were going to continue on a through trip, which he hadn't done, you know, probably in a long time. We get to the entrance, me and him, and it's a vertical pipe that we put a ladder in, almost near vertical, and then there was a short section of horizontal pipe, and when I climbed the ladder and got to the horizontal pipe, it'd been covered.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
We had even parked our cars near the Bales entrance, you know, and left our clothes and did whatever we were going to do to prepare for the through trip.
Yeah.
But we hadn't checked the entrance.
Oh.
Well, a big piece of hillside with a big tree, you know, unbeknownst to us, had come down and covered the entrance.
Oh, no.
So here we are with Gary, and the entrance is covered.
Oh,
I had a crowbar with me, and I've started, you know, chipping away at it and chucking rocks down the pipe and stuff, you know, and then quickly realized what happened was, is after I got beyond where the pipe ended, I was concerned about the ceiling possibly, you know, caving in.
Yeah.
You're just digging a loose rock, you know.
Yeah,
and
I thought,
you know, I'm not going to take a chance of making it worse here.
Oh, my gosh.
So we had to backtrack all the way. By this time, the rest of the group caught up. So here we'd been in the cave a certain amount of hours already, and now we know we're going to have to go all the way back the way we came.
Which is how long?
A few hours.
Oh, anyway. My gosh.
But, you know, it's one of those things that it's the mental along with the physical. And if, the mental can influence the physical.
Of course it can.
Big time. More yeah. than people realize. More than people who aren't used to caving. I've met seemingly macho people who didn't react so well mentally to various situations, you know, caving. But Gary, he's a trooper. He even fell once or twice. There's this section of cave called the downstream crossover. And it's muddy and you're wet anyway. And he went down,
yeah.
you know, but he's a tough guy.
Yeah.
He is tough. He just got back up and we got out.
Yeah.
Let's just say we were relieved.
And but exhausted, I'm sure.
Yeah, he was. For us, you know, I'm not suggesting that we're that much better, but you know the age difference.
Yeah.
So to us, it was like an easy trip. But for him, it wasn't so easy, especially the mental knowing that, hey, I was expecting to leave over here and I would have been fine, but now I have to go do all this stuff twice, you know, and go back out.
Wow. So can you think back to when you made some big connections, like when you connected Blowing Hole, that you kind of, from afar, those of us who are following the project, myself included, thought, okay, Blowing Hole's got to connect. I mean, it's just a matter of time. And then when we finally heard that it did, we were just like, all right, good. All right, we were right. Everyone was right that it connected. But for you, being the leader of the project at the time, that had to have felt like a big moment. That was significant. Do you remember what that was like?
Of course I do.
When that happened?
I mean, those are momentous occasions. Those kind of connections, that especially this was like legendary. Even the old ISS cavers had suspected Blowing Hole to be connected. Now, here's the thing, though. It's probably not going to be connected at base level because there's two different streams. There's a stream that goes through Blowing Hole that's independent from the stream that leaves the Bales entrance.
Yeah.
At Binkley Cave. So you're essentially, the connection is probably going to be at a higher level. And in the case of Binkley Cave, Matt, what amazes me is the drainage divides, so to speak, that this cave crosses. There are major rivers. A lot of caves you can just go in and there's your river. It's your major river. It's your major base level for that area. And stuff may feed into that, but it's not connected to this cave over here with a different drainage system or river. Blowing Hole has several, and Binkley has several parts of the cave that now we know are different main streams from each other with different routes. For example, when we found McLean River, it's a totally different river.
Yeah.
And it's a major river. So, yes, to be able to connect two separate caves together is a big deal. And also just for the fact of adding to the miles, you know, adding to the map, solving more of the puzzle, how things tie together. And in the case of Blowing Hole to Binkley connection, it really didn't facilitate easier access to anything.
Well, you always hope for that.
Yeah, you do. And there was a few things that it did. But and then Gary put an entrance in there, as you know, which, again, really didn't facilitate. The cave wasn't that accommodating at that point. I'm not saying that there's not more there. I really believe that there's a continuation of Indiana Caverns and way more cave, you know, that's higher than the level of the Blowing Hole base level.
Interesting.
But back to the connection stuff. Yeah, it's huge. And the human parts of this, that's what makes it what it is.
Yeah.
As much as I love caves, Matt, it's the human part of working caves that I love the most.
Yeah.
The caves are cool, you know, and I've seen some cool stuff, but it's the humans that do it together and the stuff that happens as a result, you know. On connection day at Blowing Hole, it was a calculated thing. Three people went Blowing Hole and I was one of the three, and then a team went in another cave called Guy Stover Pit. And again, when we connected Guy Stover Pit in and connected to Binkley, it did facilitate easier access to parts of the cave and much safer access.
Indeed.
That actually allowed that connection. I don't think we would have necessarily made that connection without the Guy Stover playing a part in that.
That was also a big cleanup effort, though, too, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That was a mess in there before you guys went in.
Yeah,
there.
It was a big mess. I don't know how they managed to cover the hole. Really, I don't. I think it was accidental. They might have intentionally threw some big things down in there, hoping that they would stop. But it was a big opening.
This was just a farm, a farm dump.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But the Guy Stover facilitated and opened the door for us to make the connection to Blowing Hole.
You were a little closer.
Yes,
yeah.
And easier to get to. And Gary was on the trip too that we made the connection. But so they intentionally that trip decided to take a cave radio in to the Big Bone Mountain Room
Which is now part of Indiana Caverns.
Which is now part of Indiana Caverns. Yeah. And a team, you know, had gone in there to that side where three of us went in on the blowing hole side. And we planned it all out the best we could. What are we going to need? We knew that there was a stream and on the Binkley side that left the main passage, took another route. And so we knew there was water. So we had a team, took some dye with them and put it in that stream, thinking, okay, if the blowing hole crew sees the dye in the water, we'll know at least it's connected hydrologically.
Mm-hmm.
And then the team and blowing hole brought smoke bombs with us because we knew the air was traveling from the blowing hole side somewhere else. So it was all kind of calculated out that way. And I got to tell a story on Brad Barkham. You know, I'd built the smoke bombs and made them of different sizes, right? And I told him, I said, don't use a big one here. Well, what does he want to do? He wants to use the biggest one that's there, right? So he lights this thing off, you know. Unbeknownst to us, we only find out later that Pat Burns is actually in the crawlway on the other side of the connection when the smoke bomb goes off. And he's just fumigated, you know, because... And later on, I find out that all the smoke went down the big walking passage and just hung there for like a long period of time. So the guys that were on the blowing or on the Binkley side are kind of like poor visibility because the smoke just went in that side and just kind of hung out and didn't dissipate, you know. So they're, oh,
God.
But they apparently got all excited. You know, Pat went back and told the others, hey, you know, and then we were able actually to make a site connection, which was not expected. We didn't really think we were that close. And it was a big deal, you know, and you just...
And then with that came the physical connection, right?
Yes, the physical connection was there. Like I said, they actually, I think Brad, who is against breakdown a lot of times and very conservative. He's way more conservative with me than it comes to certain things about caving. I was amazed at him this day. It was like he transformed into somebody else. Because he's wanting to climb this thing, canyon, and touch hands with the people on the other side that were had managed to get within touching distance of each other through the rocks and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, who is this guy? But, the connections are huge. And then the Miller High Life connection, it happened to be Tim Pry's birthday, and we decided to surprise him. His cousin Shane and I talked about it. Tim loves sandwiches, okay? You know, he'll turn anything into a sandwich, right? So we packaged up, we made some sandwiches, like a lot of meat, like meat full sandwiches.
Yeah, you know? One that you would be glad to see on a caving trip.
Oh, man. Yeah, and this is kind of stuff we don't normally bring on caving trips. So we put them in containers, you know. Shane brought some chips and somehow put them in a container that wouldn't crush. So we plan to have, regardless of what happened on the trip, we decided to have a little birthday celebration. Well, it just so happened that we made the connection that day.
Oh, wow.
You know, and Tim McLean was the one who made the connection and came back out. We all had a little birthday celebration for him with the sandwiches and chips and the cave and stuff, you know. It was memorable.
Yeah.
You know, the connections themselves are memorable, but you add in the personal part with the people that are doing it, and it's just priceless stuff.
Well, it becomes what it's all about.
It is.
Well, you mentioned Tim, and I guess this is a good time to say that you're no longer the head of the Binkley project. Kind of, when was it, would you say, that you kind of stopped being the head of the Binkley project?
And I wasn't even a tail, quite frankly, so, you know. You know, I got to back up a little bit and explain to you something else in order to get to the explanation. All right. I didn't start playing music in a band until I was age 45.
All right.
And I'm 56 now, so I really haven't been playing very long. But when I got introduced to playing in a band, I discovered it was something I really loved. Now, caving was still my first love, and so I just kind of went along with it and enjoyed it, and I realized this is something that I want to continue to do. Well, when the band eventually broke up, I decided, hey, I love music enough. I want to continue to do this. So it just so happened in January 2014, which is right after Tim McLean's passing in November, I got an opportunity to play classic rock in a band and do some singing. And it was like, it's been a wonderful thing. And because of that opportunity to do that, I started focusing on music.
Mm-hmm.
I shifted some focus from the Binkley project, started working on music. You know, after all, there is a lot to it, you know, learning songs and perfecting them and blah, blah, blah.
Sure. And
this is a professional band. So I started devoting time to that. And it was interesting, Matt, because the whole time that I was doing the Binklick project, I never got burnt out.
Mm.
Never. The hour and a half drives, it was never enough to say, gee, Dave, you know, this is getting old.
It was exciting.
Never.
It's caving.
Never. It's never.
Yeah.
And even after Tim passed, it was, okay, this happened, but the band opportunity was shortly after that, and I'd been wanting that anyway. I'd been seeking it and trying to make it happen. So it happened at that time. And I realized after I shifted and wasn't going down there every week, you know what? I don't miss this. I don't miss the late nights. You know, I would get up, I would get home, get some rest, and the next day generally feel like crap, maybe because of the schedule and time being all thrown off and that kind of thing. But it wasn't restful sleep.
Mm.
And so Sunday, a lot of times, I didn't feel like doing anything, you know? And I just thought, man, this is nice, you know?
Yeah.
I'm enjoying not doing this every weekend. And it just continually shifted away. And I have to tell you, Matt, and I have to tell our listeners that I ignored a lot of things on the home front to do this.
Mm-hmm. The Binklick project.
The Binklick project.
Yeah.
Because it was not only, you asked earlier about gear, there was a lot of time in between trips that I'm either working on gear, cleaning it up and getting it ready to go for the next trip, preparing information, preparing communication. I mean, drawing, you know, working on cave map stuff, data, writing trip reports. It was a very time consuming thing, the whole thing. And I don't have any regrets. I'm not saying that, but I am saying that I ignored a lot of responsibilities at home for that 5 years worth. I was averaging 48 out of 52 Saturdays for 5 years.
In the cave.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And associated stuff.
Yeah.
So it was a sequence of finish this trip, document, do some stuff, clean stuff up, get ready for the next trip.
Yeah.
You know,
every
rest
weekend.
On Sunday. Right. So I saw myself, first of all, when I made the shift, the music started it, as not doing that. And I also started thinking, you know what? I need to be more responsible. I live in a home. The home doesn't take care of itself. You know, I'm ignoring things, you know, around the home to do this. And I want to start being a little bit more responsible. So I've made some shifts that way. And I never got burned out, but I transitioned to a different thing.
Yeah.
And now music has overtaken my interest of caving.
I guess what it is it's just, it's so easy, you know, being connected to the Indiana caving world and seeing everything that you've done, it's so easy to connect Tim's unfortunate death to your ending, your involvement in the Binklick project, because the two happen so close together.
I can understand that.
You know what I mean? And it's easy to look at that and think, man, I wonder if that had anything to do with it.
You know what? I can't say that it didn't.
Yeah.
I really can't.
Now, because it had to have been hard.
I will attest, though, like I said, I had been, and those around me that were close to me knew that I was trying to make something happen musically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've learned that I know what I want, and it wasn't like I was just willing to accept any old project or any old people. I want to be with positive people. I want to have a good time, especially in my free time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of being selective about who I wanted to play with or those kind of things, you know. Wasn't just looking, grasping for any project, you know. Mm-hmm. It had to be the right people and situations and stuff. But so it was no secret to those who even were in the Binklick project that I was seeking to do that. And it just happened coincidentally enough to happen close to that time. And I certainly can understand why people might think, I'm not telling you it didn't have any impact on me.
It probably
That's not
had
what I'm
something.
Saying. Of course it did. It's probably has some impacts that I'm not even aware of. And I'm not in denial.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that it happened around that time.
Yeah.
In fact, I was one of the people who felt like things happen in life.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to think that I'm one of these guys that if I was trying to ride a horse and it threw me, that if that's what I wanted to do, I'd just get back up on the horse.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so with him dying, it just happened that he died in a cave.
Yeah.
You know, and it's what I did anyway, caving. It's what he did. He died doing what he loved.
It was like what Joe said on the podcast. It was a good death.
Well,
he died doing something he loved.
How many of us maybe would prefer that to happen?
Yeah.
You know, death affects the living.
Yeah.
The person's gone. You don't know any better, as far as I'm concerned. Now, nobody knows, obviously. There's a lot of ideas on that we're not going to get into, but death affects the living. And there's no good way to go.
No.
So I got to be, I'm volunteering here because I know you said you know, we're willing to bring up this discussion. It was one of the hardest days of my life, but I would not choose to have been anywhere else. You know, Tim lived in Brownsburg, and he had a long drive. He had like a 2.5-hour drive to go caving in Binkley. Now, one of the routes that he could take was through Bloomington, but that added on to his trip. So he did come through periodically, and I'd hook up with him to share rides down together, which was a huge, sharing rides was part of the thing that I liked about this. Give me an opportunity to visit with people, which I love. And the car time is different than the cave time, because when you're in a cave, you're focused on other things and you're talking about other things, and car time was always valuable. And on this particular day, he met me and close to my house, and we rode down together.
Mm.
And I wouldn't trade that for anything, Matt. As hard as it was to deal with in the cave, I wouldn't trade that.
Because you can look back on that as...
He was doing what he wanted to do. I was doing what I wanted to do with a guy that I loved. And it was tough.
Yeah.
Everybody's different, Matt, in the way that they process things. And I'm not... I mean, everybody's going to have their own take on it. It's going to affect different people in different ways. Death is a part of life, unfortunately. And it was a terrible thing that happened. But he was an incredible guy. And I have nothing... but wonderful memories of him. I consider it a privilege to have had a relationship with him, and he was a part of my life that was really, we shared some wonderful times with other people, and have nothing but a wonderful memory of him. So what can I say? I'm grateful.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to start wrapping things up. Is there anything that you brought that we haven't touched on yet?
There's actually a few things. One of the things I want to tell you, first of all, in addition to the cave being cooperative, you know, my wife has been incredibly cooperative and accommodating of me doing what I've done, not only with the Binkley Project, but just caving.
Yeah.
You know, I stopped caving for about 12 years or so to be a stepdad.
Mm.
You know, we invested time into my stepdaughter and did stuff, and there was a gap there. And I think being a parent's one of the most important things a person could do. So that was a good thing. And they didn't really like caving. She's tried. She's tried several times like it. We know that it's not for everybody. But I got a shout out to her for being so... I couldn't have done what I've done without her support and without her accommodation, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I wanted to do, Matt, I thought you might want to have me on as a guest. I wanted to hear what everybody else had to say. And so there are just a few little things that I want to touch on. Spelunker versus caver.
Okay.
I thought about writing an article for the SS on this, and I haven't done it. This is not a diss toward anybody. So if you're listening to this and you don't agree with me, that's fine. I'm not asking you to agree with me. I would like to suggest that sometimes cavers have come across as pompous to the non-caver.
I would agree.
Who only knows the word spelunker and associated with visiting a cave.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a mistake to make a big deal of that to the person who doesn't understand. Now, am I suggesting that we shouldn't explain it? No. I'm suggesting that some cavers make a really big deal of it. Oh, no, I'm not a spelunker. You know, how could you call me a spelunker? You know, it's the reaction. It's how it's presented.
Yeah.
I'd like to suggest, if you're out there and you really feel truly about this, then think about what this person is intending by asking you. Are they putting you down? Are they intentionally putting you down by calling you a spelunker? Probably not. Think about how you're going to come across to this person.
I think we need to share this more. I think we need to share caving more. You know,
absolutely.
NSS membership is down.
Well, it's just the use of the word. You know, back in the 50s, cavers called themselves spelunkers. Okay, they did. If you look it up and look what's been published and printed, that was just a term. And now we have decided, oh, that use of this term is different. I'm not dissing you out there who feel strongly about this. I'm just asking you to consider the audience and how you can present it in a light such as, you know, my main goal is to talk about caves with them. And if I'm talking to a landowner, I want to come across as, you know, look, I explore caves, but I always tell them I approach this professionally. I'm very careful, you know, and we talk about all the things, that, the reasons why we're careful and why they should let us on their property and in their cave. But I don't care if they call, you're a spelunker, you know. It's just a term that they associate with exploring a cave. So, and again, my feelings, I just wanted to throw that in there and give it as food for thought, who, people, you know, who might encounter that. If you're called a spelunker, I really don't think the person who's asking you really wants the full explanation or a how dare you call me a spelunker kind of stuff, you know. Another one.
Binkley is not all nasty, Matt. Regardless of some of the statements that you might have made based on maybe some assumptions that you drew from other people.
And I have to tell you, I've never been in the cave.
I understand that.
I've never, and right. So it's not fair. You're right. It's not fair for me to make that assumption.
Notice that I didn't say that, though. I just said I wanted you
well,
to know,
I will be the first
for the record,
to say it.
Binkley is not all nasty. In fact, there's more walking than any single cave that I've been to in Indiana. Now, is the walking in a park, you know, strolling, da-da-da-da-da-da, it's not that kind of stuff, you know. One thing that a lot of people I've noticed struggle with is once the water gets stirred up and you can't see your feet, a lot of people feel like they want to see their feet, and which is an understandable thing, you know. You want to see your feet when you're going through the cave to know where to step.
Sure.
And Binkley Cave, no. Once the water gets stirred up, visibility's gone.
Yeah.
Forget it, you know. We used to give people what I call the virgin privileges. Yeah. I've taken first time cavers to Binkley Cave.
Yeah,
you know, and it's not a bad first time cave.
Sure,
you know, there's some water, and I warn them of that. But it's different. People aren't used to that kind of thing. Then it can become a real obstacle for people. And I've watched people struggle with that. But it's not all nasty, Matt. Really, it's not. Now, is there a define nasty? I'm not going to define nasty. If you think it's nasty and you go, then that's not for me to tell you it's not nasty, but I'm here to suggest that maybe it's not quite as nasty as what you might think in your mind.
I have been wanting, admittedly, to go to Binkley and visit and go to some of the best places for a long time since you were leading the project. And I just was never able to, or I never made the time. It's not that I was never able. I just never made the time. I'll admit. And so I do want to go and have a good first Binkley.
Now, is it Marengo Cave? No.
No.
You know, and is it Wyandotte Cave? No. You know, I'm not suggesting that it's the best cave in the world or that it's the most beautiful or anything like that. I'm just saying it's, you know, I don't know what pictures you've had in your mind. Yes, there's some slop in there. And yes, there's some nastiness, but... Miller, I think, has been maybe possibly a little bit over exaggerated, you know, as well. Again, it's caving.
Yeah.
Caving is not about comfort.
No, God, no.
You know, it's about doing difficult things maybe and pushing one's limit. I think I talked about this, but I really want to suggest the importance of survey and documentation is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And in the caving world, and in other scientific worlds, too, if something isn't published, then
it doesn't exist.
There's less, kind of, yeah, I've heard that said that way. It doesn't exist. Well, it does. Maybe, you know, trip reports and stuff. Look at Facebook.
Yeah.
There's so much stuff on Facebook. I've been grappling with this, and I don't have the answer, but there's a lot of information being documented on Facebook. How is that going to get officially documented, or will it? I don't know. That's not for us to decide, but it's tough because everybody's putting information out there. Some of it's probably useful information to cavers or that should be documented in a different, you know, in a more of a publishing kind of aspect. But that's huge. There's something that was said in an earlier podcast that I would like to clarify, and I'm not a rescue expert, okay? I don't know if you've talked to Anmar and Don Paquette, perhaps, you know, about the possibilities of doing a podcast.
Yeah, and Anmar's agreed to it. We just got to set up
right.
a time.
Well, and I think they'll tell you this, and I'm not trying to speak for them, but I'd like your listeners to know it's a bad idea
to hear about a cave rescue and go show up to volunteer. Those people that do that might be well-meaning, but they're actually complicating things.
Mm.
Because there's a structure.
Yeah.
There's a definite structure. Those people then turn into somebody that needs to be fed and cared for.
Yeah.
And the rescue people have got this down to a science. They know, and they have networks, and they will use the networks to what they need to do. So I would encourage you, if you are wanting to help at a rescue, try to get tapped into the network. Like, for example, the Central Indiana Grotto is part of the network.
Yeah, we've got what we call the Dean's List.
Yes. And so the right people have that information, and there's a list, and they can be picked from that list. So, again, I'm not trying to pretend I'm the expert on this, but I know it complicates things.
Yeah.
And a complicated thing.
You go to orientation to cave rescue, the OCR, and you learn that.
Again, but there's a lot of well-meaning people who may or may not do that.
Yeah. But there's emotions involved, and if someone they know is the subject of said rescue, you know, it's going to be hard to fight them away, but you got to think about that sort of thing.
Well, and let me tell you, while we're talking about it just briefly, and I don't mean to take up gobs and gobs more of your time, but the Binkley, when the cavers were trapped down there last
December,
it was one of the hardest days of my life.
God, I bet.
Because I knew not to just get in my car and go down there.
Yeah, so you're just kind of stuck.
And I'm stuck thinking. And I don't want to come across as like the authority on this, but I probably know Binkley Cave as well as or better than anybody around right now. And here I am sitting powerless at home to do anything.
Yeah.
That was tough, Matt. Absolutely tough. And I find out later there's some issues. Maybe that Jess Deli did contact me later on in the afternoon and stuff. And I had talked to Gary and I knew what was going on to a certain extent, but they had some map issues later that all they had to do is pick up the phone and talk to me. And I probably could have given them some ideas that would have helped them mm-hmm. with a particular dilemma, but it was a tough day.
Yeah.
And my mind started going to places because I know some of the people that were in there
mm-hmm.
and I know some of the things that they could have done. And let's just say that could have easily been a multiple fatality kind of situation. You know, if they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, could have been, we won't speculate on that, but it had a good outcome, but it was still a very difficult for everybody to go through.
But they were also solid cavers.
They were, most of them.
It came as little surprise that they were able to identify the problem before it became a huge problem and were able to get to high ground.
Oh, totally. I've got to give kudos to Laura. You know, Laura really impressed me. She's been taking rescue training, advanced rescue training, I would call it, mm-hmm. you know, doing a week-long seminars and stuff. And she really, she was the backbone of that. You know, she held it together, I believe,
mm-hmm.
based on what I've heard. And I'm really proud of her. But I think there's something for everybody in caving, regardless.
Yeah.
You know, I've chosen certain paths. I've watched other people choose paths. You're choosing a path that previously I didn't ever heard of anybody doing what you're doing. So, you know, it's cool. There's something for everybody.
Yeah. I'm just a recreational caver who talks to real cavers.
But it's awesome. And you're doing an awesome thing. I want to shout out and appreciate the past guests who've like, you know, mentioned me or complimented me or whatever. I love people and I am careful, or I try to be careful about my relationships and how I treat other people and how I involve them in the project and how, you know, all that sort of thing. And I really appreciate the people that maybe that I've had a positive impact on that acknowledge me in your past, you know, episodes and stuff. And Joe Kinder and Gary and John and Nick and Laura, you know, not saying I'm not out there looking for this stuff, Matt. I'm just doing what I'm doing. And that's the way it is. But I do appreciate the people that respond to me and have responded to me and have gotten something from my relationship with them. You know, it's always a two-way street. I've certainly enjoyed those relationships with other people, and it's kind of a win-win sort of thing. I would love to go caving with you.
Oh my God, are you kidding me?
Yeah, and
let's go.
Well,
where do you want to go?
And I just want to. We don't have to decide that now. But I want to tell you, all somebody needs to do is ask me.
Yeah.
You know, now the nature of what I'm willing to do right now with my schedule and with my, you know, my physical whatever might not be what I would have done, you know, in the past.
I would even consider, you know, going to Binkley Cave and taking there on like a, what I would call introductory kind of trip or something, but I would like to go caving with you. So
yeah,
you still, after our time here today, you're entitled to change your mind. You know,
I will not. I absolutely will.
If you'd
not.
Like to, I'd love to and consider it an honor to do that sometime with you. And, landowners are so important.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That's big.
I would like to suggest, and I've seen this happen, cavers love to go in caves, and they love to come out of the cave, and they love to post on Facebook about it. And if you haven't thought about this, folks, I would like to suggest that, did you ask for permission from the landowner to post something on Facebook?
I hope so.
Well, but I don't think it always happens.
Oh, and of course not.
And I'm not suggesting that I would never do that. I'm asking everybody to think about it. Mm-hmm. There's a network. Facebook is a network. And I say it's bad business for caving to go do something like that. Put it on social media where even if a limited, you think a limited amount of people can see it, it's still out there for a lot of people to see. And I think it would be best if before doing that, you know that it's okay. You know that the landowner accepts that as being mm-hmm. okay to do. Because you know what? The state caves are closed.
Yeah.
And we rely on private landowners to go caving, or the few caves maybe that the IKC owns, a handful.
Yeah.
That's a little bit different. But I just like people to maybe think of that. Be extra careful when it comes to that kind of thing. I don't think there's anything really that, I mean, gosh, you've been so gracious in your time, and this was as easy as I knew as it would be. Because you just make it so easy to converse and chat.
Well, if I've taken away anything, I've taken away that for you, caving is a social activity.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It's more than that.
Well, yeah, of course it's more than that. But
because I'm pretty.
You're a people person.
I'm project driven, though.
You're project driven.
I'm project driven. It's to accomplish something. It's not just to get together and usually for me. It's not just to get together and have fun. Now, I will guarantee you this. I am going to look for a way to have fun, period, regardless of what I do.
Whatever trip you and I take, it'll be a fun one.
Well, I'm going to make my best to do it that way. And you know, I can't cave with everybody, but I've also learned that I don't necessarily really want to cave with everybody because humans are different. And they don't always mesh, you know, the same way. So I'm not suggesting that I can have the same fun trip with anybody. But basically, that's my goal. If you like me and my type of humor and my approach to things, great. If you don't, I'm not offended. You know, not trying to get you to like me. I'm not trying to get you to like caving. It's not like that. It's just like, hey, let's go have some fun. And regardless what happens, whether it's a recreational trip or whether it's a work trip, which I've taken many.
Well, okay. I guess to wrap up, if you could possibly answer this question, why? Why do you like caving? What is it about caving that has driven you crazy over the last, 30 plus years?
It just encompasses so many things. When I first got introduced, I thought it was an amazing blend of nature, which I'd been used to, obviously, outside stuff. You know, I love nature, love hiking. You know, not that I've ever been an avid hiker or backpacker or anything like that. Nothing like that.
Whenever you get
the chance. The outdoors.
Yeah.
I love the outdoors. And I love the physical part of things, you know. I'm not the guy who just enjoys walking along a straight level trail or something, you know. Give me a challenge here.
And this is a challenge.
So caving encompassed the physical, doing different physical things to get through the cave, and in an environment that very few people get to see, including some beautiful. Matt, I can look at mud banks and say they're beautiful. I'm serious.
Yeah.
It's like I can find the beauty. When I first started caving, it was about racing through the cave and, oh, we're done with that one. You know, later on when I went back and saw some of those same caves, I thought, this is a really nice cave. And I didn't stop to smell the roses, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, but caving encompasses the physical inside the caves. And for me, it also involved other things outside the cave. It involved writing about the cave, which you have to think about. It involved making maps in a certain amount of, you know, that part of it, and the pictures and just different things that it brought a lot of things together that are things that I like to do. And then the project part of it, I like coordinating people. I like trying to. I'm glad I don't get, I used to get paid to do it, which wasn't so easy. You know, I used to think I could get along with everybody. And I learned that I wasn't quite as good as that, good at that as what I thought I was. So if it's for pay, maybe it wouldn't be as much fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, but I can pick and choose and kind of the coordinating of the project. I really try to get people on board that, you know, at different levels that they get something out of it. That's about all I can think of. I could talk forever, like some of the other guests you've had on. And that's the other thing that really amazed me. It's like, you've had some amazing guests on this show, and just the ability to get them talking and stuff is just so cool. I put some people on this list who I'm guessing you probably maybe have already talked to and maybe aren't willing to do this format, but I encourage them to consider doing it, because there's people that have devoted their life to caving. Yeah. Their lives. Yeah. I haven't devoted my life. Mm-hmm. There's people that have devoted their lives on this list I'm going to give you, like Keith Dunlap and Tom Ray.
Oh, I know.
You know, and other people. That's just two that come to mind. Keith is so selfless. He has just done so much, and he's not out there looking for the pat on the back.
No, he's
you know,
not.
What I'm saying.
But he's involved.
Oh, he's just, it's amazing. I don't even know the half of it, quite frankly. One day I call him up, and it's like, he's helping the DNR design a bear trap or something like that.
Which
like,
I saw at his house.
It's like, really? It's like, my goodness, what don't you do? Right?
And he's retired. Yeah, he's doing all this in retirement.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I expect to be as busy in retirement or busier than what I am now, if I ever get to that point.
Yeah.
But, Matt, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you, Dave.
And spending the time with me. And all you people who have listened to this out there, thank you for listening. If you want to go caving with me, just contact me and I'll try to make it happen.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on the podcast, Dave.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Dave. What a guy. I appreciated all his kind words that he had for the podcast. I tried really hard not to just edit them out. I don't like to make it about me, but I also appreciate his ringing endorsement. He talked about a list. He made a big list of cavers that he'd love for me to talk to, and I'd love to get to the people on that list. I had a great time with Dave, and thanks to his wife, Sherry, for waiting in my living room and putting up with my dogs and my wife and kid while we talked. Caver spouses who don't cave should be eligible for sainthood. That's all I'll say. Hey, thanks for listening. This podcast comes out on the first of every month, and next month we kick off what I hope will be a year of big guests. My plan is to mostly get out of Indiana for 2018 and get some big names going in the new year. If you've emailed me, I still have your email and I have a running list of your suggestions, and I'll be getting a hold of them to set up interviews. If you'd like to email suggestions for guests, or you just want to email me and say you like the show, or maybe do this, whatever, you can email me at alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. We will kick off the year in January with, get this, current NSS president, Gary Schindel. We will see you next month for that. I'm so excited. As always, support the podcast by supporting our sponsors, Organic Robot on Etsy, Swago, he's testing new material for packs. A couple of prototypes were on that Wayne trip I mentioned earlier and held up really well. Stay tuned and visit swagogear.com. And of course, you can directly support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/cavingpodcast. Or a free way to support the podcast is just to rate it on iTunes. Only takes a few seconds. I'm Matt Pelser, chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.